Testing. Okay, good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox of Sunday School class. Dr. Ross is with us today. We're continuing his talk on the wonders of the universe. And Dr. Ross will not be here next week. We have a special guest, Mr. Ted Bates, and he'll be talking about mankind trying to be God. So that'll be real interesting. We do have an announcement. We lost one of our members, Big Jim Miller. Some of you may remember him. He was a beloved person in this class. Let me read. There's a memorial set up for him on October 28th, Chapel of the Gardens, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific time. That's in 2300 North Marengo Avenue, Altadena, California. So if you want more information, just see me later on that. And and with that, let me say a prayer and we'll get started. Bow your heads, please. Bless us now, Lord, with your presence in this room. We seek your protection for Israel in this time of war. We also seek solace for the family, for our beloved departed class member, Jim Miller. Anoint your word and by our pastor today, Dr. Ross. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Ross, come on up, please.
Well, thank you. And if you don't remember Jim Miller, he was the tallest member of our class. He was 6'9". And he was here just a few weeks ago. And I realized he was only 6'4". And he basically told me, yeah, my health isn't doing well. But he passed away just a few days ago. And I was asked to do the funeral, but I'm going to be in India on October 28th. Ross Hoagland will be doing the officiating at his memorial service. And Ross will be in class next week. So, Jim always had an encouraging word for me and for many of you. He had a special gift for doing that. So I'll be here for a couple of Sundays in November and all the Sundays in December, but the rest of the time I'm going to be traveling and speaking in India, in China, North and South Carolina, and Virginia. So the fall is always a heavy travel time for me. But we've lined up some really good scholars that will come here and be able to speak in my absence. And hey, if you ever want to watch or download a previous Paradoxes class session that includes the Q&A, go to paradoxes.org. It's all archived there. And you can watch or you can share it with a friend. If there's a particular topic you're interested in, feel free to take advantage of that. So. Just this past Monday, my 22nd book got released, this book here, Rescuing Inerrancy, A Scientific Defense. where I basically respond to what's happening in the community of theologians worldwide, where they're saying we can no longer believe in the doctrine of biblical inerrancy, at least as it's defined by the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy. So they're busy redefining the doctrine. You say, why are they doing this? They're saying science no longer allows us to read the Bible as a literal historical text. The Bible is inspired when it speaks about doctrine and how we're to treat one another and relate to God, but they don't no longer believe it's accurate when it speaks about history, geography, and science. What I found ironic is that it's non-scientists who are doing all this. And then I've been named in many of the books that they've been writing, claiming that biblical inerrancy is no longer defended. And it was really a group of theologians that I've known over the years that came to me and said, Hugh, you need to write the book. We could write it, but you're the scientist. You're the one that's being attacked. You need to write the book. So I have written the book, and within a month, we're going to release several papers that these theologians who came to me have written, basically in support of the conclusion of this book. The book is not for sale yet. You can't buy it on Amazon, but anyone can get a copy of this book by a donation to any amount to Reasons to Believe. So go to reasons.org. There's a page there where you can make a donation, and a copy of this book will be sent to you. We really appreciate our donors and always give them an advanced copy of the book. And people ask me, well, Hugh, you're writing another book? Yeah, I'm about two-thirds of the way through finishing my 23rd book, and it's going to be a book on Noah's flood, because I found out that these theologians, that text, even more than the creation text, is something they believe is not scientifically credible. So as a scientist, I'm basically saying, yes, it is credible, it is defensible. So I appreciate your prayers during the next few weeks as I'm involved in all these travels. Traveling to India and China is always a challenge. Also, I need to be doing some writing while I'm speaking there. They really want me to have that 23rd book finished by no later than the end of December. They're hoping I can give it to them by the beginning of December. Well, we're in a fairly lengthy series about how the universe, in all of its components, in every event in its history, has been designed not only to make a home for us human beings, but to make it possible for billions of us to be redeemed from our sin and evil. And as I mentioned in previous weeks, I've actually written, over the past 35 years, 7 books that basically lay out how our universe and all of its subcomponents indeed has been designed. Last week, we talked about how if you want human beings on a planet, the star or the solar system must be born in a dense cluster of stars, way denser than this one. It actually has to be a cluster like this. It needs to be 20,000 stars jammed tightly together. You say, why do we need to be born in a cluster? And incidentally, clusters like this are rare. There's only a little more than 150 of them in the entire Milky Way galaxy. And most of them are in the outer fringe of the galaxy or near the core of our galaxy. We were actually born in one of these dense star clusters that is about a little more than about halfway closer to the center of the galaxy than we are now. And the reason why is that, as I've been mentioning, we need the elements that you get from the merging of neutron stars. Only when two neutron stars merge together to become a black hole do you get the production of about 48 of the elements in the periodic table. So most of the elements in the periodic table, including those that are essential for all of us to be alive, molybdenum, iodine, and tin, those are what we call vital poisons. Too much in your body will kill you. Too little in your body will also kill you. But these elements are very difficult to be constructed in the universe. You really need to have these two neutron stars merging together to become a black hole. And that merging event needs to be the just right distance from the emerging solar system and the just right time in its history in order us to get the adequate enrichment of those rapid process neutron elements without being destroyed by the merging event. And these merging events are extremely rare. Astronomers have only observed two of them in the entire universe. Now, there's a caveat with that. We've only been looking for 4 years. But you know, the universe is big, 2 trillion galaxies. Surveying those 2 trillion galaxies, we've yet to see just two, which means these are very rare events indeed. Now, something I didn't share with you last week, mainly because it wasn't published. I've got the article written. It'll be coming out in November. But one of the things they discovered is not only do we have to be born in a dense star cluster where you got supernova eruption events occurring, because they also contribute to the elements that the neutron star merging events don't make. And you need this huge star cluster in order to have the possibility of simultaneous core collapse supernova eruptions, type 1A supernova eruptions, and a neutron star merging event happening within the time window that's essential for us to be enriched with these heavy elements. We've also been able to discover it takes particular structures of filaments within the birth cluster. And so this is a little diagram that I've developed out of the paper that was published a few days ago, basically making the point that stars and star clusters form when you got this gigantic ball of gas and dust, what we call an interstellar molecular cloud. So it's a cold, dense gas, cloud of gas and dust, and it begins to gravitationally collapse. And as that gravitational collapse, it leads to the production of stars. But one thing that astrophysicists have just discovered, for these stars to form, they form only at what are called along filaments. Now, so what this diagram is basically showing you are filaments and hubs. You say, what's a hub? Hub is a place where you get these long cylindrical, so you think of this, you got a huge ball of gas and dust, but within that ball of gas and dust, you got these thin straw-like cylinders. And those thin straw-like cylinders are especially dense in the gas and dust. And it's only along those filaments that stars can form. So in the vast majority of this huge ball of gas and dust, stars are not forming. In fact, you can see this when you look at these gaseous nebulae where new stars are forming. And most of that interstellar molecular cloud, you simply have hot gas that's expanding, which is actually counter to the production of stars. The only place that stars are able to form is along these long, dense, cylindrical, straw-like filaments. And so when you get this huge ball of gas and dust, within it are all these little filaments. So think of it as just a whole bunch of strands distributed throughout the ball of gas and dust. And what astrophysicists have just discovered, again, the paper just published a few days ago, is that along these long filaments, you can get stars like the sun forming, and stars that are smaller than the sun, are slightly bigger than the sun. But the really big stars can only form where you got filaments coming together in a hub. And you need at least 4 of these filaments to come together and join together at a hub to get a big star forming. Now, the reason why that's important, you need these really big stars. They're the only ones that are going to go supernova. They're the only ones that will end up as neutron stars, where you can get 2 neutron stars merging together. And by the way, as I mentioned last week, to get 2 neutron stars merging together, you need 2 big stars that are orbiting one another, where both of them undergo a supernova eruption and they end up as neutron stars. And as they continue to orbit one another, they lose gravitational energy and they begin coming closer and closer together, and eventually they merge and become a black hole. But to get the big stars, you need to have these hubs. And now, not every gas cloud that's forming stars has these hubs. So in some of these gaseous nebulae, we do see stars forming, but no massive stars. To get the really massive stars, the ones that have the possibility of becoming supernova and ending up as neutron stars, We need to have these filaments coming together at different places and forming these hubs. And the more filaments that come together, then the bigger the star that can form. Now, what I've shown in this diagram is the fact that, you know, these filaments are of different lengths. To explain the fact that the solar system didn't get destroyed by being too close to one of these big stars and yet got the enrichment of heavy elements that it needed, we need to form along an exceptionally long, dense filament. And so this diagram basically shows you that, where you got the solar system towards the end of a really long and dense filament. Now, if you're too close, you wind up getting destroyed. So you want to be far enough away that you're going to survive the encounter with a massive star. But what happens is that the heavy elements that's being produced by the supernova eruption or is being produced by the neutron star merging event, those heavy elements will be funneled along the filament and sent to the solar system. So we get safely enriched with all the elements we see in the periodic table. And you know, my wife is saying, well, maybe, Hugh, you need to wear the T-shirt, because I got a T-shirt sent to me by one of our supporters in Missouri, and it has a periodic table on it, and says, I wear this shirt periodically, but only when I'm in my element. So maybe some Sunday I'll come and wear that T-shirt for you. But the whole point is to get all those elements you see in the periodic table. It's necessary that we be close to the stars that are forming these heavy elements, but not so close we get destroyed. And what keeps us safe is we have this long filament. So think of it as a drinking straw, where you're drinking the fluid, and that's what's happening. The solar system, the emerging solar system, is basically siphoning all these heavy elements as they're being blown out along the filament. But this research paper was just published basically makes the point, this is an exceptionally rare event, because these long filaments are not at all common. In fact, the birth cluster in which we're born is extraordinary, and there was such a long filament where we could be safely enriched with all the heavy elements we need for life. So I just thought I would share that with you. You won't see it in any book. It literally just got published. And I'll write an article where you can actually see the links to the peer-reviewed papers. They'll be coming out on some Monday in November. Every second Monday, I produce an article called Today's New Reason to Believe. But hey, I'm literally giving it to you today. A new reason to believe that we live in a universe and a galaxy where you can see that it's been supernaturally and super intelligently designed, so we have all the elements we need for our advanced civilization. Because yeah, as you look at those R process elements, what you notice is some of them are essential for existence, the rest of them are critical for a high technology civilization. Things like gold and silver, platinum, uranium, thorium. Those are all these rapid process neutron elements that are only made by neutron star merging events. But these are the elements that are extremely valuable and the elements that help us to sustain our advanced civilization. As I briefly mentioned last week, that I was going to explain this to you, is that this is basically a map of our Milky Way galaxy, and it's a high-precision map showing what our Milky Way galaxy looks like. But what I'm showing here in this diagram is where our solar system was born. And that location is the location within our galaxy where you get the highest density of heavy elements, these R-process elements. So we're born in the best possible place to be enriched with the heavy elements we need for advanced life, but there's no way you want to stay there. If you stay there, the density of stars is such that it's going to disturb the planetary orbits, and the radiation from nearby stars is going to be deadly for advanced life. But as I hinted at last week, what happened is, at just the right time, we got ejected from our birth cluster. And we got ejected in the same way that NASA gets spacecraft to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and beyond. You know, those planets are far away, and it's expensive to send a rocket ship there directly. So how NASA saves your tax dollars is that they will send the spacecraft up, and they ensure that the spacecraft passes by one of the nearby planets, where the planet gives the spacecraft a gravitational kick and sends it out into the outer solar system. And so you want to know why they have these rather weird trajectories? They're looking for that gravitational kick so they don't have to use as much fuel, and also it gets them to where they want to go years faster than it would take if they were just simply to send the rocket there directly. Well, in the same way, our solar system got a gravitational kick. In fact, it got such a strong kick, it got completely ejected from the birth cluster. Say, how do you pull that off? Well, how NASA will get, say, a rocket to Uranus or Neptune is they'll send the spacecraft close by to Venus, and Venus gives it the gravitational kick. But to get a strong enough kick to take us out of the most dangerous part in our Milky Way galaxy and have us end up in the safest part, one star will not do it. You basically need three or four or five, six stars in a particular orientation, big stars, where the solar system comes at just the right distance from those stars and gets an especially strong gravitational kick and gets sent out into the outer part of the solar system, and we wind up just inside that little red annulus. Now, you actually need a braking mechanism, because that powerful kick that sent us out of our birth cluster should have kept us going to the outer edge of our Milky Way galaxy, which would not be best for advanced life. It's important that we stop at what's called the co-rotation distance. I'll explain why that's important in a minute, but in order to stop us at just the best possible place for advanced life, it's then necessary, after the solar system gets ejected from its birth cluster and it travels about 10,000 light years out from the center of the galaxy, that it encounters another group of big stars, where those big stars act as a gravitational brake, slowing down the movement of the solar system and stopping it and putting it just inside the co-rotation distance. Okay, what is that co-rotation distance? Well, the spiral structure of our Milky Way galaxy, the spiral arm structure, it rotates like a rigid disk. But the stars go around the center of the galaxy according to Newton's laws of motion. And I don't know whether you studied that as a junior high student or a high school student, but think back to Newton's laws of motion, if you will. And it was basically Newton who said, hey, the laws of gravity tell us that the closer a body is to revolving around another massive body, the faster it revolves around that body. And we can see that in our own solar system. You know, Mercury goes around the sun in about 3 months. Venus takes about 9 months to go around the sun. Earth takes 12 months. Mars takes about 2 years. And so the farther you are away from the sun, the longer it takes to revolve around the center of the sun. Well, that principle, as Isaac Newton pointed out, applies to all celestial bodies. And so in our Milky Way galaxy, the farther a star is away from the center of the galaxy, the longer it takes to make a revolutionary trip around the center of the galaxy. You say, well, how long is the year of our solar system? You know, a year is the length of time it takes our Earth to go once around the sun. And so when you're celebrating, say, your 40th birthday, you're celebrating 40 trips around the sun. So, you know, I won't tell you how many trips around the sun I've had, but you can Google it and find out, okay? And I'm looking forward to a few more trips around the sun. Okay, but the sun is making a trip around the center of the galaxy, and the year for the sun is 250 million years. It takes a quarter of a billion years to make one revolution around the center of the galaxy. Now, here's the problem for advanced life. You don't want to be hanging around these spiral arms. The spiral arms are where you have a lot of gas and dust. That's where you got these giant molecular clouds. That's where you got these supermassive stars that are pouring out deadly radiation. And so when our solar system passes through a spiral arm, one of the big spiral arms, it runs into these giant molecular clouds. It gets close to these big stars. And we notice is every time the solar system passed through the spiral arm, it ignited a whole bunch of asteroid and comet collisions. Because the gravitational disturbance that the solar system experienced when it passed through one of the big spiral arms basically destabilized one or more of the asteroid and comet belts. There are five asteroid and comet belts around our sun. And so when you look at the history of the Earth, you notice there have been these episodes where we've been bombarded by giant comets and asteroids. That happens when you pass through a spiral arm. And so there have been times when an asteroid hit the Earth and wiped out two-thirds of all the species of life on planet Earth. In fact, there's been five extinction events where at least half of all species of life are wiped out. The most devastating one was the Permian-Triassic extinction. That was 90 to 95% of all species of life. Now, and typically, the lower life forms survive okay. The bacteria aren't too disturbed by these events. But it's devastating for creatures as advanced as birds and mammals and dinosaurs. And so the dinosaurs were wiped out by a big asteroid hitting in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. So you do not want to be crossing spiral arms very often. Now, that red annulus you see there, that's the distance from the center of the galaxy where the revolution of a star is the same as the rotation rate of the spiral disk. And so, however, you do not want to be exactly at the co-rotation distance. Because of the fact that exactly at the co-rotation distance, you've got the spiral arm structure rotating, that rigid spiral arm structure rotating at the same rate that a star at that distance revolves around the sun, that actually sets up what's called a mean motion resonance. In other words, the identity there basically disturbs the orbital position of the star. And what happens is the star either gets sent farther away from the co-rotation distance or sent closer. And so, ironically, if you're exactly at the co-rotation distance, you're going to be crossing more spiral arms than if you're just inside the co-rotation distance, because you're going to be suffering one of those resonances that pushes you out or pushes you in. The best possible place to ensure you don't cross spiral arms very often is just inside the co-rotation distance. You say, well, how often do you cross a big spiral arm at that distance? Once every billion years. You say, well, when are we due to cross the next big one? A half billion years from now. When's the last time we crossed? Half a billion years ago. So we're in that sweet spot where we're in between the passage between a spiral arm. And that's because of the fact that we're just inside the co-rotation distance, and so we're able to stay at that distance. It does mean we cross spiral arms occasionally, but instead of crossing a spiral arm, say, every 50 million years, you wind up crossing it only once every billion years. Now, we do encounter some of the minor spurs and small arms, as you'll see in the slides I'll show you in a few minutes. But there the disturbances are way less than they are with the major spiral arms. So this is where you want to be. And we refer to this as the galactic habitable zone. That's a term you'll see in the scientific journals and even in the popular level books now, is we have these planetary habitable zones, where you're at the appropriate distance from the star, where liquid water can exist on the surface. But in addition to the planetary habitable zone, we got the galactic habitable zone. The galactic habitable zone is that region just inside the co-rotation distance. This is where life is possible beyond a microbial level. And so, for example, I've got astronomer friends who are trying to find planetary systems in which life is possible. They're focusing their attention on the galactic habitable zone. They know if they go towards the center of the galaxy, you're not going to find habitable planets. If you go too far away from that co-rotation distance, you won't either. This is the place to go to find planets that are possibly habitable. Okay. Now, I put online yesterday that I was going to speak today about the local bubble and the local fluff. How many of you have ever heard of that term? I mean, that's part of your address. You live in the Milky Way galaxy, you live on the local arm, you live on the local bubble within the local arm, and you're inside the local fluff of that local bubble, and then you're in the solar system. So yeah, if you want to tell somebody your complete address, that's kind of how you would need to go. There's more items you can put in that address, as I've been sharing in previous weeks. But let's zoom in on this. And what we see is, okay, this shows you the two big spiral arms that we cross about every billion years. You've got the Sagittarius arm and the Perseus arm. And so these are the dominant arms of our Milky Way galaxy, a place where you've got really dense, huge molecular clouds and these big stars that are a problem, certainly a problem for advanced life. Now, we are on, well, not exactly on, we're kind of off the edge of what's called the local arm. The local arm is a small, it's actually, the term arm is not appropriate, it's not a real arm, it's kind of a spur that came off of the Perseus arm. So if you go back along the local arm, you see it joins up with the Perseus spiral arm. So it's a split, a small arm that splits off from the Perseus spiral arm. And we're not exactly on that arm, and what you're seeing here is a two-dimensional image. We're in three dimensions. What you notice is that we're actually quite a bit off of that local arm. But one thing you can see in this image is that our position within that local arm is an under-dense region. And so what you notice is there really aren't any nearby places, giant molecular clouds where stars are forming. The nearest one is the Orion Nebula. How many have ever seen the Orion Nebula? You can actually see it with the naked eye. You have to go to a dark place, but it's the one star-forming nebula you can actually see with the naked eye. And it's easy to find. Orion is the brightest of all the constellations in the sky. You've got the giant star Betelgeuse, big red star at the top. You've got Rigel, another big bright blue star at the bottom. And in between, you got what's called the three belt stars. So very recognizable. But hanging down from the belt is three fainter stars. It's called the Sword of Orion. The middle star is the Orion Nebula. It looks like a star, but it's actually a nebula. And get out your pair of binoculars. And by the way, it'll be nice and high up in the sky at midnight tonight. Yeah, you can actually get a look as early as 11. Christmas time, 8 o'clock, it'll be up. So you'll be able to get a good view. It's kind of a Christmas a tradition we have in our family. We look at the Orion Nebula on Christmas Eve. And all you need is a pair of binoculars. A good pair of binoculars will actually show you, not a star, but you'll see kind of like a little fuzzy cloud. And it'll be green in color, that's ionized oxygen. And if you've got a small telescope, it actually brings out the red colors, and you can see newborn stars. Even in a good pair of binoculars, you'll be able to see some of the newborn stars in the Orion Nebula. But the good news is, it's 1,400 light years away. Far enough away that the radiation and the gravitational pull from the stars that are forming there pose no problem to our civilization here on planet Earth. But this is extraordinary. As you look at this image here, this map of the local region of the Milky Way galaxy. You notice all on the spiral arms, you see these little pink spots. Those are the maternity wards of our galaxy, where new stars are being born. Those are the places you don't want to be near. And you don't want to be near the bright star clusters along the spiral arms either. But even in this image, you can see we're inside that local bubble, and the local bubble's position where there are no nearby giant stars and there are no nearby maternity wards, these gas clouds where new stars are forming. Yet everywhere else along the spiral arms, you see that it's filled with these giant stars and gaseous nebulae. And then one of the unique features of our Milky Way galaxy, it's a huge spiral galaxy, 1.2 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. It's not a giant galaxy, but it ranks as a large spiral galaxy. But it's the only large spiral, by the way, life is only possible in a large spiral galaxy. If you want to know why, you can go to paradoxes.org and look at previous class videos. We need to be in a large spiral galaxy. But the Milky Way galaxy is the only large spiral galaxy we've seen to date where all the maternity wards, these gas-forming places where new stars are forming, none of them are big. You know, last Sunday, I basically showed you the closest spiral galaxy to our galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud, and how it has these enormous gaseous nebulae in it, basically making advanced life impossible anywhere within the Large Magellanic Cloud. Same thing is true of the Andromeda Galaxy, but our galaxy, yes, we got hundreds of these gaseous nebulae that are forming stars, but they're all small. And the Orion Nebula, which is the closest one to us, is one of the smaller ones. Okay, what about this local bubble? The term bubble, astronomers have defined as basically spherical bubbles within our Milky Way galaxy, close to spiral arms, where there's a great underdensity of gas and dust and stars. And so astronomers discovered we're an unusual region along this co-rotation distance where we happen to be in the middle of a bubble. And a bubble is basically, well, think of like a soap bubble. A soap bubble, you got stuff on the surface of the bubble, but inside it's empty. And so that's kind of where we are. We're in the middle of a bubble, but the bubble is basically empty of stars and gas and dust. Not completely empty, but much under dense compared to everywhere else within our Milky Way galaxy. And it's that under density of gas and dust and stars that allows us to have advanced life here on planet Earth. Now, you haven't always been in a bubble, and we'll be leaving that bubble shortly in the future. You say shortly? Yeah, within about a billion years, we'll be exiting that bubble. You know, a billion years is not that much time when you're talking 14 billion years for the universe. But right now, we're in a bubble. Moreover, we're in the middle of that bubble. And so that explains why when we look at the stars in our vicinity, in fact, you can go online and it'll give you a list of all the stars within 20 light years of our solar system, basically exhausting the entirety of the local bubble that we're in. And what you notice is there's no giant stars on the list. There are a few stars about as big as our star, the Sun. You got Sirius, which is about two or three times bigger than our star, the Sun. But the vast majority are less than half the mass of our star, the Sun. And the luminosity of a star basically goes up with the mass of the star by the fourth power. So a star that's twice as massive as the Sun will be 16 times brighter. But a star that's half the mass of the Sun is 1/16 as bright as the Sun. And so because we're in this local bubble, the stars in our vicinity are no problem for advanced life here on planet Earth. The vast majority of them are these very dim stars, and none of them are close enough for the radiation flaring activity to be a problem. And the few big stars that we do see in the list are far enough away they pose no threat. Now, the one that's probably the most risky for us is the star Sirius. It's only a little more than 8 light years away. But it's not so big that its radiation poses a problem. However, it will go supernova. You say, what happens when Sirius goes supernova? We'll all be in serious trouble. But it's a sufficiently small star that we now know that there's no risk that it's going to go supernova anytime within the next several million years. And so it's not a risk. In fact, the star that poses the greatest risk for us is the star Betelgeuse. That's one of the stars you see in the constellation Orion. And astronomers are carefully watching it, and they say, yes, this is a star that's going to go supernova any time. But any time to an astronomer means any time within the next 50,000 years. So they really can't tell, but they do know that it's beginning to show the spectral signature that we see in stars that are typically getting ready to go supernova. It's 300 light years away, and you say, well, what would happen if it went supernova? It would really be bad news. Now, it wouldn't wipe out the human species. We can survive a supernova eruption that's within 300 light years. It would shorten our lifespans. The cancer rate would skyrocket, but it wouldn't be the extermination of the human species. But it would certainly devastate our civilization, our population level, because it would actually affect crops. When you get a supernova exploding that close, it affects the crop productivity, so we wouldn't have the food that we need. So yes, it would be the end of civilization as we know it. But hey, we're not at risk right now, but as astronomers say, that is the one that's the riskiest, but fortunately, it's quite far away. Okay, as we go inside the local bubble, we find an interesting thing called the local fluff. And this is what the local fluff looks like. The local fluff is basically a region within the local bubble where you've got some dust and gas. And the dust is of a certain character that it acts as a block against radiation that would otherwise be a problem for advanced life. Now, we're moving around within the local bubble, but currently we're dead center in the local fluff, which is in near the center of the local bubble. And so, yes, about 200,000 years ago, the sun moved into the center of the local fluff. Well, God created humanity sometime during the last ice age, sometime between, say, 40,000 years ago and 120,000 years ago. God timed it so that the local fluff would protect humanity so that we'd be able to quickly populate the earth and develop the civilization. After all, as you heard in the sermon this morning, God created us to be managers of this planet, to manage its resources for the benefit of ourselves and of all life. That requires that we have a large population. It also requires we have the technology and the civilization to be able to do the management that God has put us, has asked us to perform. And so that little red dot there basically shows you where the solar system is. And that little yellow spot there basically shows the densest part of the dust within the local fluff. So we're actually in the best region within the local fluff. Local fluff itself, because of its dust, is blocking out the deadly radiation, but we happen to be in the core of the local fluff where that dust is exceptionally able to block out that deadly radiation. And we entered that about 200,000 years ago. We're going to be exiting that within the next 100 to 200,000 years. But this is one of several things I've put in my book, Design to the Core, how you can find over 15 what we call narrow windows, a narrow time window in which human civilization and a high human population is possible. And this is just one of those narrow windows. But to me, one of the most powerful arguments that indeed the universe and all of its components must be supernaturally designed so we can fulfill all the purposes which God created us. All these narrow time windows, which are independent of one another, simultaneously line up and overlap. in just that window of time in which God created us, that window of time where we can actually fulfill all the purposes. Now, this also implies that the Creator is going to return relatively soon. I mean, that's the core doctrine of the Christian faith, that the Creator of the universe came to planet Earth 2,000 years ago. He came as a humble servant, sacrificed himself on the cross so that we could trade our moral imperfection for his moral perfection. But he's promised that he's going to come back. And he's going to come back and do away with all sin and evil and suffering and take us to the new creation. We know that's going to happen relatively soon, because relatively soon we're going to be exiting that best possible spot within the local fluff. So this is something you can do in terms of adjusting your beliefs about end times prophecy. The Lord will return in less than 100,000 years. Because I've run into some theologians that think it's going to be 30, 50, 50 million years out. I said, no. He's got to come back before we exit the local fluff. So it's going to be less than 100,000 years. In fact, I think it's going to be a whole lot less than 100,000 years, because Jesus made the promise, I will come back as soon as those of you who are my disciples take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. When you've done that, I'm coming back. And Ralph Winter, the one who founded the U.S. Center for World Mission in Pasadena, he's passed away, but he would attend this class. And he was the one that wrote a book and several articles making the point that Christians today have the people, the finances, and the technology to fulfill God's command in one decade. We don't have to wait 100,000 years or 10,000 years. And I remember talking to Ralph saying, yes, I agree with you. We have all the resources we need to fulfill the Great Commission in just 10 years. But Christians worldwide lack the motivation. We need to find some way to motivate followers of Jesus Christ to take advantage of the resources God has given us. And to me, the strongest motivation is life is going to be a lot more enjoyable in the new creation than in this creation. John 16:33, in this world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. In this universe, you got thermodynamics, gravity, and electromagnetism. And because of those laws of physics, you will experience tribulation. I mean, look at one another. We're all evidence of ongoing decay in our physical bodies. And that ongoing decay causes us to have pain. I don't run as fast as I used to run when I was in my 30s. I don't run as far. I'm actually observing that there's been some degradation in my human body. This is inevitable because of those laws of physics. But those laws of physics were optimally designed by our Creator to be tools in His hands to efficiently and rapidly eradicate all the evil and suffering. The new creation, where He'll take us, as soon as we take the good news of salvation to all the people groups of the world, it's a brand new realm where there is no gravity, where there is no thermodynamics, where there is no electromagnetism, and therefore no tribulation. There'll be no cancer, no heart disease. Your chin's not going to sag under the influence of gravity as you get older. That's not going to happen to that part of your body and other parts of your body. We're going to have these incredible bodies that are going to remain uncorruptible for the rest of eternity. Okay, I've gone over time. I'm going to stop there, and we'll take questions. And as always, in the Paradoxes class, we take questions on any topic. It doesn't have to be related to what you just heard. And we'll alternate between people that are here in person and people that are participating online through our virtual audience. Got an online question?
Justin asked, what happened on Earth to the transition it from the heavy bombardment stage to when we first see life? Then a second question, what was the transition like?
Okay, I think he's referring to what scientists call the late heavy bombardment. This is an event that happened about 3.9 billion years ago, when we were crossing one of those spiral arms, and we got bombarded. It's the heaviest bombardment that the Earth has ever experienced since its formation. And so we're talking tens of thousands of big asteroids and comets pounding into the Earth and actually turning the Earth back into a molten state. And that's this condition which would be deadly for all life on planet Earth. But then the bombardment ceased, the planet cooled down, rocks began to form again, solid rocks, liquid water. And this is the first time on planet Earth where we had stable liquid water and stable rocks. Now, there were times before 3.9 billion years ago, although the farthest back we can go is 4.1, where you got brief episodes where the Earth had liquid water on some parts of its surface and solid rocks. Very rare. There's only a few places in the world where we find evidence for solid rocks and liquid water previous to 3.9 billion years ago. But by 3.84 billion years ago, for the first time, you got liquid water on most of the surface of the Earth and solid rocks on most of the surface of the Earth, where they never again become predominantly molten and evaporating. The amazing thing is we have isotope evidence that we see abundant life, microbial life, in diverse forms on planet Earth 3.825 billion years ago. And the error bar on that is now quite accurate, plus or minus 0.006 billion years, which tells us the moment that the Earth became suitable for life, life instantly appears. And this has caught the attention of such leading atheists as Niles Eldridge. Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould were the ones that came up with the punctuated equilibrium theory. Both of them are atheists. And Niles Eldridge basically wrote a book that said, one of the most startling things I've ever seen in my scientific career is the very moment that life can possibly exist on the Earth, life exists. Now, as an atheist, he concluded life must be intrinsic to the Earth. In other words, he speculated there must be some hidden law of physics that the moment that conditions are possible for life, it instantly appears. Well, that hidden law of physics, from a Christian worldview perspective, is none other than the Creator himself. The moment conditions on Earth permitted the existence of life, God created life. And he didn't create just one microbial species, he created an entire ecology of microbial species. The isotope evidence now reveals you get anaerobic microbes, and you also get aerobic microbes, and you get aerobic microbes that are capable of a broad range of photosynthetic activity, which tells me that the Creator was aggressive in making sure that the planet was prepared as rapidly as possible for the entry of human beings. You say, well, 3.8 billion years doesn't sound too rapid. Well, it is. Given the laws of physics, that's as fast as you can bring human beings upon the cosmic scene, and it can only happen if the origin of life takes place 3.8 billion years ago, where the life is abundant and it's diverse. Now, if you want to read more about that, it's in our book, Origins of Life. I also created an update on that whole problem of the immediacy of life appearing on planet Earth in my book, Improbable Planet. Okay, next question.
Yeah. If A.J. Roberts were here, she would remind us that also God created viruses to keep the bacteria under control.
I'm hearing you.
Yeah, A.J. Roberts was here. She would tell you that that God also created viruses to keep those bacteria under control, which is amazing. My question is when you were describing the birthplace of the sun, you were interchanging the word sun and solar system, which leads me to be confused on when our solar system actually formed. Did it form in the birthing place or in our final orbit place now?
Okay, good question. And yeah, I was interchanging sun and solar system because they are interchangeable. The planets form at the same time the sun forms, and the planets basically stay with the sun. So when astronomers refer to the sun forming, they literally mean the entire solar system because the planets remain attached to the sun with a couple of caveats. The solar system, when it first formed, had 10 planets. We had 5 rocky planets and 5 gas planets. One of those rocky planets collided with the new forming Earth, and then one of the gas giant planets got ejected from the solar system by a gravitational interaction with Jupiter and Saturn. But eight remained. And by the way, we need one of those planets to be ejected, one of those gas giant planets to be ejected in order to have advanced life on planet Earth. It was the ejection of that fifth gas giant planet that ensured that Mars would not be too big. Because the way the way planet formation works is that the farther you get away from the sun, the greater the mass of the rocky planet. And notice that rule works for Mercury, Venus, and Earth. And so as you get farther away from the sun, notice that the planets get more massive. Mars is the exception. It's only 1/9 the mass of the Earth. And literally for a 30-year period, astronomers were baffled by what they call the tiny Mars problem. Mars should be twice as massive as the Earth, but it's only 1/9 the mass of the Earth. And it took 30 years of intense research for them to figure out how our solar system wound up with a tiny Mars instead of a big Mars. And the answer is, it's that fifth gas giant planet being ejected in just the right way by the gravitational interaction of Jupiter and Saturn while Mars and the Earth were still forming. And so it didn't prevent the Earth from getting more massive, but it substantially reduced the capability of Mars getting more massive. And yeah, it'd be bad news if Mars was twice as massive as the Earth. It would certainly be bad news for us astronomers, because that means that you've got Mars up there in the sky with a lot of bright light. I mean, because Mars has almost no atmosphere and is only 1/9 the mass of the Earth, it's not that bright in the nighttime sky. You know, Venus, fortunately, is closer to the sun, which means it only is a problem for astronomy in the early evening and the dawn. The rest of the evening, because it's orbiting the sun closer to us, it doesn't get that high up in the sky. But Mars being farther away, it means it's up almost all night. And it would be incredibly bright and be a problem for astronomy. But also its mass, being as big as it is, would have affected the formation of the Earth, and we would not have the conditions we need for advanced life. A little longer answer to the question.
It leaves me with other questions. So the moon forming event, did that happen then in our birthing location or where we're at now or somewhere on the trip or whatever?
Yeah, well, we got ejected from our birth cluster fairly quickly. We know it's less than 10 million years after the sun first formed. And it could be as little as less than 2 million years. And so the solar system takes about 20 million years total to form in terms of all the planets and the asteroid and comet belts. And so a lot of it would have been intact. We know that the 10 planets were intact while it was still in the birth cluster. So exactly when do we have the ejections taking place? The dates are not that firmly established. We do have a good date for when Theia, the fifth rocky planet, collided with the Earth. Well, it's 95 million years ago, plus or minus 30 million years. So that's not that well determined either, but that would have been well after we got ejected out of the birth cluster.
How long would the travel time approximately be from our birthing spot to our current spot? Last question.
Question, how long did it take us to be ejected from our birth cluster to wind up where we are right now? The answer you'll see in the scientific literature, we know it's less than 100 million years. And we know it's more than 10 million years. So the error bar is pretty big. It's basically 50 million plus or minus 50 million. Okay, next
Hi,
question.
Hi, Dr. Ross. This area called the local fluff, I understand, is an area full of gas and dust, and we're kind of in the center or the best place in there to be protected from radiation outside hitting us. And my only question is, wouldn't that affect our view of the night sky and our astronomy and seeing everything?
My microphone back on. Yeah, the density of gas and dust is not so extreme as to affect our astronomical observations. particularly because we're in a local bubble, which is, tends to be under dense. But we're in this local fluff, and it's the type of dust. Mm-hmm. It's not the dust that's posing a problem, so the size of the dust makes a difference, mm-hmm. but it is blocking out the radiation, which would be a problem. The other thing the local fluff did that I forgot to tell you, it has an impact on the heliosphere, which is basically, you know, the sun has a wind blowing out from it, and so, and there's particles coming up from the sun. The local fluff is basically compressing the heliosphere, and so it has two effects. It's basically limiting solar radiation impacting the Earth. It's also limiting cosmic radiation, and it's assuring that the radiation we get from the sun is roughly the same as we get from the cosmic rays. And so that's another part of the design feature. And you want the, and that's one of the things about planet Earth. It's at a distance from the sun where the cosmic radiation is about equal to the solar radiation. And so that's really the best place to be to protect advanced light. So if we were Venus was, we would be getting more solar radiation than cosmic radiation. Out by Mars, you get more cosmic radiation. We're in that place where the two are balancing one another, and we get the least amount of dangerous radiation.
Thank you.
Okay, we have an online question from Valerie. Is the dark matter that allegedly holds the Milky Way together exotic or common dark matter, and what is the difference?
Okay, yeah. In previous weeks, I made the point that one of the unique features of our large spiral galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, it's embedded within a gigantic dark matter halo. A halo composed of matter that does not interact strongly with light. So it's not made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, which powerfully engages with photons. And so I think I showed an image. Matter of fact, I think I can pull it back up here for you. Let me... Here we go. Okay, this shows you the dark matter halos surrounding our Milky Way galaxy and our Andromeda galaxy, and basically shows you that the dark matter halos surrounding our Milky Way galaxy is about four times bigger than the halo surrounding the Andromeda galaxy. And our galaxy, 90% of its mass is dark matter. In the case of most spiral galaxies, it's about 50%. So we have this huge amount of dark matter. The halo is big, and this basically shows you a plan view of that halo. So that dark gray stuff is the dark matter. What you see there, that light gray that surrounds the spiral structure, that's a halo of ordinary matter. So that light gray is a halo, a disk made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons. But then that really gigantic dark gray, that's the dark matter halo. And the black there shows you the spiral structure. And here's a side view, basically showing you that the gaseous disk is made up of gas that's protons, neutrons, electrons. It's slightly bigger than the spiral disk, but it's flat like the spiral disk. And then you see the spiral arm structure and the central bulge of our Milky Way galaxy. But then you see that gigantic, slightly flattened ovoid dark matter halo. And yeah, it's that dark matter halo, because of its distribution of mass, it works to stabilize the spiral structure. So one reason why we have this amazingly symmetrical spiral arm structure, it's largely due to that huge dark matter halo. And so, come Thanksgiving Day, which is coming up next month, you might want to thank God for this huge dark matter halo that embeds our Milky Way galaxy so all of us can enjoy Thanksgiving dinner.
Isn't it Thanksgiving in Canada this month?
Thanksgiving in Canada is tomorrow.
Ah, see? Okay.
Hey, we who have dual citizenship, we get to celebrate it twice. Well, by the way, what you might not know, the Canadians had a Thanksgiving Day long before the Americans did. But they have it in second Monday of October because their harvest comes a lot earlier than it does here in the United States.
Of course.
By November, there's just snow everywhere, right?
Okay, I hope I can ask this coherently. If I get all tangled up, I'll yield to Tim. So RTB's thesis is that there's that we can make that our faith and science are related, and that there's predictive power in that ongoing scientific revelations will affirm that God created us and that He's interested in us, and you know He's involved in our lives, etc. So today, for example, we heard that there's this local fluff region that we happen to be living in, and it's congenial to life, and it, you know, it's part of why we can live the lifespans we have, etc. We expect that there will be progressive scientific findings as we go, and as there have been over the past 30, 40 years of your ministry, that affirm that God is sustaining life and cultivating life. But that would imply that, say, 30 or 40 years ago, we would be scratching our heads and saying, how is it possible that we can have a lifespan of 80 years when we should be bombarded by all this radiation or whatever other physical effect? Until the local fluff was discovered, which I presume is in the last 10, 20 years, I don't know. But so that's the nature of my question. We have these ongoing scientific revelations and findings, which we say, aha, there, you see, there's God at work and He's making the universe congenial for us. But we weren't asking those questions, at least I'm not aware of your ministry asking these questions 40 years ago. So is my view correct? And are there questions we have right now, like how is that possible? Because we don't see evidence for how we could be protected from radiation or temperature or what have you, but we expect to find that evidence in the future.
Yeah, good question. And yeah, if you read the articles at reasons.org written by me and Fuzz Rana and Jeff Smirink, what you'll notice is, and our scholar community people, those questions typically come up when we're making new discoveries, and the new discovery will answer one doubt or question that we had, but it exposes several more we weren't even aware of, which causes us to dig a little further. And so the questions often emerge when we answer a previous question. And so you're right, 30 years ago, people were even thinking about, okay, you know, how come we're able to live this long? They were aware, well, somehow we're protected from radiation. And so they were saying, well, we do see this balance between cosmic radiation and solar radiation. That's gotta be a factor, but is it the only factor? And we're now discovering, yes, it's a little more complicated than what we thought. And often what happens, we are too optimistic in thinking, aha, we got the answer that explains the issue. Then we dig in a little more and says, well, that answered maybe half of the problem, but not the other half. These other things take care of the other half. Then we study that and say, well, we're actually wrong in thinking they cover the other half. They only cover about two-thirds of the other half. And so that kind of what drives our research. But the interesting thing about that research, it gives us a progressively stronger and stronger case that it's supernaturally and superintelligently designed, because the design becomes more complex and more fine-tuned as we discover more and more. And I personally try to emulate that through this blog series I have called Today's New Reason to Believe. And in those articles, you'll see I'll pose, these are the questions we're trying to answer. These are the new questions that we need to answer. And so an area where that's happening right now is, okay, what's happening in the first few billion years of cosmic history? And so an article I'm working on right now, probably won't come out until December, I think the first Monday of December, is that astronomers have discovered these first stars that form in the history of the universe are not as efficient at making heavy elements as we thought they were. End line is that means it's all the more miraculous that we've got the heavy elements we need right now, but actually answers the question that often people ask. Does life really require that we be orbiting a third generation star? This thing that just got published that I'm working on right now basically says yes, a second generation star won't work. It has to be a third generation star. And you say, what about a fourth generation star? The universe isn't old enough yet for fourth generation stars.
Thank you. Hello, Hugh. I have a brief announcement and two questions. The announcement is that the Carnegie Observatories, which is over on Santa Barbara Street in Pasadena, is having their open house right after this event today. It's an annual thing, but this is special, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Edwin Hubble's discovery of the galaxies, basically, it'd be a really nice event. I've been in the past, so, and just public is welcome.
Okay, public is welcome, and in case you don't realize, they're located in Pasadena, 813 Santa Barbara Street, just a little bit north of Caltech. They're having an open house, and they have a phenomenal library. It's worth going there just to see their library. That's where I go if I want to find the old journals, because they've got a collection, and they leave them intact as books rather than just putting it all online. And you can actually see the notes of people like Edwin Hubble. I'm sure they're going to have some of that on display. And an astronomer that used to attend here regularly, Alan Sandage, he's passed away. He was Edwin Hubble's student who continued his research program on the expansion of the universe and the age of the universe. He became a believer while he was working there at the Carnegie Institute, and he continued working there literally till the day of his death. In fact, just days before his death, he was working on the last research paper that he was publishing. And, you know, people say, is that true of astronomers? Yeah, they never retire. They just keep working. They're having way too much fun doing their astronomical research. They literally keep it up right up until their deathbed. So, but yes, thank you for that announcement. Definitely worth your while to go there and see what's going on and talk to the astronomers there. Yeah, now your question.
So, two questions. One, you had on your picture of the local fluff, there was down in the left corner something said called a tunnel to the local super bubble, and I was wondering what that is. And then the other question is whether these filaments in the galaxy that the stars can form along, the physics of that process, is that similar physics to the intergalactic filaments that we see in clusters, superclusters, and beyond?
It's different than the filaments that we see, because the filaments we see along these huge bubbles in the universe, I'm trying to think of the technical name for it. I got a whole chapter on it in the Design to the Core. Let's see, where is this thing? Boy, I didn't know I went back that far. Here we go, come on. Here we go. Yes, I think you're referring to that thing at the lower left there. And astronomers are working on the local fluff, and they're realizing it's not as stable as we thought it was. It's changing shape, things are moving, and we see funnels of gas leaving, funnels of dust leaving, also funnels coming in. So this is still ongoing research. I'm predicting that we're going to find even more design features in local fluff than we know today. But yeah, they're still trying to figure out exactly what is the dynamics of the local fluff. They've just recently determined the date when the sun entered the local fluff, when it came towards the center, and the likely time it will leave. But the complicating factor is this local fluff is quite dynamic. It's changing shape, it's changing movements, and so the estimate of when we leave is kind of up in the air, because we can't really predict what the future dynamics of the local fluff will be. So ongoing research, and if anything else gets significantly discovered about the local fluff, we'll try to keep you up to date. Now, you had another question?
Yeah, it was if the physical processes or the physics and whatnot of these filaments we see in the galaxy that we're supposedly born in and stars form in, that kind of physics, the same kind of mechanism that is affecting the intergalactic filaments. We talk about bubbles and super bubbles there, just like you are here. I don't know if that's what's going on.
Yeah, and technically that's referred to as a cosmic web. So we look at the universe on very large scales. We're talking hundreds of millions of light years across. We see that it's structured with these gigantic bubbles, where at the core of the bubble, you've got this dark matter. And on the surface of the bubble, you've got the ordinary matter, which are the galaxies and galaxy clusters. And galaxies will form along these filaments, subfilaments, and you get the supermassive galaxies forming at where filaments come together. And groupings of galaxies are where subfilaments come together. So the filaments we're seeing inside the birth cluster of the sun and also all gaseous nebula forming stars, they're roughly similar to the filaments there, but the physics and the dynamics and the shape is quite different. For example, I was giving the analogy of a straw. Okay, in the case of the cosmic web, the diameters of the straw are a lot bigger than what we see in the case of these gaseous nebulae. But again, it's ongoing study. I mean, the thing I'm writing about that'll come out in November or December, I think, it's basically just the initial research on these filaments. Now, astronomers have known that these filaments exist within gas form or star forming gaseous nebulae. What's new is their understanding about the hubs. That's new, and the paper ends by saying we need to do a lot more research. So the story is not yet finished.
You were out of time. There is one more question. We'll try to get it to you another time.
Okay.
Thomas Oy. Sorry, Thomas. We'll get back to you later.
Okay.
Can you lead us in prayer, please?
I'd be happy to do that. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. We thank you for every day you give us to live here on planet Earth. And Father, I pray as we live each day out that we live in such a way as to humble ourselves before you and make sure that you're the ones that are glorified. So help us to love one another. And Father, I pray that we'd be sensitive to your Holy Spirit, giving us opportunities to share your love, life, and truth with people that need to receive it. And help us to be more receptive to receiving it ourselves. In Jesus' name, amen.